This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Washington Today for December 18th, 2023. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us. On Capitol Hill, Senate lawmakers from both sides of the aisle say they're encouraged with the direction of talks on border security, but they remain unclear about when they'll reach an agreement. Negotiators have been huddled together for weeks as they attempt to reach a deal that will also unlock additional aid for Ukraine and Israel. We'll hear from Senators Schumer and McConnell and get the details from Politico legislative reporter Ursula Pirano coming up. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Tel Aviv today, meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli top officials. Among the topics of conversation, Gaza's future and the need to stabilize the situation in the West Bank, where violence among settlers has erupted, and in the north, where Hezbollah terrorists have been firing rockets at settlements and military sites. We'll hear from Secretary Austin and Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant coming up. The body of the late Sandra Day O'Connor, the nation's first female Supreme Court justice, is lying in repose in the court's Great Hall today so the public can pay their respects. Among the dignitaries who've come by, Vice President Kamala Harris and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff. We'll hear what current Justice Sonia Sotomayor had to say at a private ceremony earlier today that included all nine current justices. Sandra Day O'Connor died on December 1st at the age of 93. We begin in the Senate, where Oklahoma Republican James Lankford, Arizona Independent Kyrsten Sinema, and Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy are leading the talks on border security. Here's Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer.
Over the past week, Democrats and Republicans have made important progress towards an agreement on the National Security Supplemental. While the job is not finished, I'm confident we're headed in the right direction. I want to thank all the members and staff from Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans, and the White House who worked through the weekend to get us closer to an agreement. I can imagine that they're tired after working virtually nonstop all weekend, mornings, evenings, mornings, afternoons, evenings, and coming into the I can imagine they're tired after working nonstop, coming into the office early in the morning and working furiously in the evenings. With the holidays around the corner, they're sacrificing time with family, their kids, and have to put travel plans on hold to get this done. I salute my colleagues and staff for their excellent work, and I'm encouraged by the progress we made over the weekend, significant progress, and I urge them to keep going. Now, we all know this is extremely difficult work, among the most difficult things we've done in recent memory. Everyone knows that something should be done to fix our broken immigration system, but we can't do so by compromising our values. Finding the middle ground is exceptionally hard, and both sides must accept that they will have to make concessions, and it's going to take some more time to get it done. But we must succeed. Democrats remain committed to working with our Republican counterparts to reach an agreement.
According to multiple reports, the two sides held more meetings today. Here's the leading Senate Republican, Mitch McConnell.
Over the weekend, our colleagues continued to make progress toward an agreement on border security. I'm especially grateful to Senator Lankford for stewarding Senate Republicans' efforts to produce meaningful policy changes, fix our broken asylum system, and secure the southern border. Addressing the border crisis at home is a fundamental part of legislation that will help America meet each of the most glaring national security challenges we face around the world. And there are a number of significant issues our colleagues are still working to resolve. The effects of years of failed border enforcement are compounded. Border security policy is complex, and our colleagues at the negotiating table are clear-eyed about the fact that getting this agreement right and producing legislative text is going to require some time. Senate Republicans will not make up for others showing up late to the table by waiving our responsibility to carefully negotiate and review any agreement before voting on it. And I'm encouraged by our colleagues' commitment to keep making steady progress in their negotiations over the coming week and beyond. America is facing a never-before-seen border crisis. An imperialist thug is trying to redraw the map of Europe. A repressive authoritarian state is preparing to put more of the Indo-Pacific under its control. And the world's largest state sponsor of terror is showing us it's as determined as ever to kill American service members and disrupt global commerce. There is simply no room for falling short here. We cannot afford to get this wrong.
The headline at Politico.com, Congress unlikely to finish work on Ukraine border deal this year. Legislative reporter Ursula Perano is here to tell us more. The House is in their holiday break right now, but Senator Schumer canceled the Senate's break in order to get this deal done. According to your Politico story, Senators Lankford, Sinema, and Murphy met for 3 hours yesterday. Did they make any progress?
It does seem like some progress has been made. There are certain items that negotiators are saying are checked off the list, though they are being rather secretive about what those items are. But it's clear that there are a number of issues left for senators to tackle this week. As senators start to come back into the building today, there is a vote at 5:30. It doesn't seem like we're going to be seeing anything as far as a grand deal revealed within the next few hours. There is expected to be more meetings today, but a lot of people are sort of waiting anxiously to see if text actually drops. They want to see some sort of physical text they can read through, litigate, talk to folks and lawmakers about, and start considering whether or not they could support that bill or propose amendments to that bill, whatever it may be. So that's really what's got folks sticking around, but I do think tonight's vote is going to be sort of a vibe check on how many senators actually felt inclined to stay in town, which could be a signal on if they actually think a deal is going to be coming through this week.
Generally speaking, what are the sides looking for in a border deal?
Republican senators want something akin to H.R. 2, which was a House immigration bill that had a lot of conservative priorities. A return of sort of Title 42 expulsion authorities, reining in the ability for asylum seekers to make claims, sort of continuing to build the border wall, a very almost Trump-era immigration policy package. Democrats love these things. There's been some signal of openness to fixing the asylum system. There has been some signal to talks about, you know, general parameters that can be taken slow. Some of the crossings that have been ticking up within the last few months at the southern border. But some Democrats do want some of their own priorities put into this package as well. They're talking about things like Dreamers and making sure that Dreamers can get, you know, the status that they're hoping to achieve in the U.S. But it doesn't seem like Republicans are really open to those priorities making it in this go around, since this is really a matter of leverage for Republicans. They know that Democrats want Ukraine aid, and in turn, they are taking this opportunity for all they can, and making sure that they are getting the most out of it as well.
Now, you mentioned, and in the political story, the sides are talking about things like changing asylum standards, but they're still talking about other issues like the migrant removal process and expulsion authority. Where are they with that on getting a deal done?
Those seem to be some of the things that are the biggest holdups. Those are things that are turning away some Democrats. There are even Democratic senators who are very eager to see the supplemental package get through, who have voiced concern for these issues being on the table. The fact of the matter is that this is a one-time spending package where permanent policy changes are now up for negotiation as part of the trade-off. There are a number of Democrats in the Senate and in the House where they don't think that should really be the case. They think that this isn't the arena for a border deal. Border is obviously such a complicated issue that constantly escapes Congress almost every time that talks begin. And so there is a lot of sort of worrying happening among some of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but including some of the more moderate wing of Senate Democrats about what's actually up for grabs at this point.
According to the Politico.com story, Republicans are also pushing for policies that Democrats largely object to. What are those issues?
So I think the issues that are really at the core of what Democrats want to object to is tightening asylum claims too much. That's something that we definitely hear a lot of Democrats concerned about. They want to make sure that legitimate asylum seekers who are seeking safety and safe haven in the United States are not turned away. That's a key issue. There are some other priorities that were put into some of the original GOP proposals, like continuing to build the border wall, expanding expulsion authorities, that Republicans really want. They've made very clear that this is sort of the cost to get the supplemental package across the line, that Democrats are pretty averse to. But what is tricky at this point is that these talks have been very secretive. We are not hearing a lot of detailed readouts from senators. And I do think that is something that a lot of senators are eager to sort of hear more about what's actually happening behind these closed door meetings. So we'll have to see what comes out this week as far as any actual readouts or texts that other senators can dig through and sort of pinpoint what they could and could not get behind.
And just yesterday, a group of Republicans wrote a letter that called the negotiations rushed and secret. Who were those members who signed onto that letter, and what are they looking for?
So those were mostly Senate Republican conservatives like Mike Lee, Ron Johnson. They feel that, one, this is a rush process, that it's being done behind closed doors. They want to know more about what's actually on the table. They also would like to see it happen after the holidays. They are pushing for a special conference meeting among Senate Republicans the week of January 8th, and they want the opportunity to sort of actually talk out what's happening here. In tandem, what they're doing, too, is buying House time. Even if the Senate were to pass something this week, it's super clear to everyone in the building that Speaker Mike Johnson is not going to rally the House to come back the week before Christmas to get this across the finish line. So there is some sort of quarreling among Senate Republicans about how much they should actually be sitting around forcing us through this week when it ultimately isn't going to be able to pass the House this week anyways. A lot of senators wanting to get home to their districts, to their families before the holidays, and some frustration about being in town when it's not even clear that a vote's going to happen.
Of course, aid to Ukraine is tied to this bill, and the White House said last week that congressional failure to authorize new aid to Ukraine will severely hurt them on the battlefield. Are there any disagreements about Ukraine aid, or are the two sides pretty much in agreement on that?
I mean, among Senate Republicans, there certainly are people who do not want more Ukraine aid. How they actually come down on this particular bill that has other priorities like Israel aid as well for them and potentially a border deal is yet to be seen. But by and large, the Senate on both sides is largely behind Ukraine aid and is hoping that this can be sort of the motivating factor to get it done sooner rather than later. Some of the concern about letting it go past the new year is that there will be government funding deadlines coming up. That's going to take away a lot of the momentum for any sort of large supplemental talks. They're already going to be talking about a lot of spending for regular government funding and then adding on a $100 billion plus supplemental package to those talks obviously adds a lot of heat to the fire for conservatives in the House and the Senate who aren't a big fan of year-end spending bills or large spending bills. So that is a big part of why folks are trying to get this done before the holidays.
The headline, Congress unlikely to finish work on Ukraine border deal this year. You can read it at Politico.com. Legislative reporter Ursula Perano, thanks for making time for us today.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Washington Today.
My name is Nate, and I'm part of the team at C-SPAN that brings you live coverage of Congress and the day's top political events unfiltered. As a nonprofit organization that receives no government funding, we're asking for your help to support C-SPAN's daily operations. Please visit cspan.org/donate to learn more and consider making a one-time or recurring tax-deductible donation. That's cspan.org/donate.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Tel Aviv meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other top officials today. Following the meeting, he and Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant spoke to reporters. Here's Secretary Austin.
On October 7th, Hamas committed one of the worst atrocities in the history of modern terrorism. As President Biden said, it was an act of sheer evil. Innocent young people at a concert were massacred. Parents were shot in front of their children. Women were sexually assaulted. Toddlers and Holocaust survivors were taken hostage. And for Hamas, that was just the beginning. Hamas has clearly and loudly spelled out its vision of the future. And it is to repeat October 7th, over and over and over again. No country should tolerate such a danger. And Israel has every right to defend itself against a fanatical terrorist group whose stated purpose is to murder Jews and eradicate the Jewish state. Hamas is still holding hostages, including American citizens. Hamas embeds itself and hides itself behind innocent Palestinian civilians. Hamas does not speak for the Palestinian people. And Hamas is determined to doom both Israelis and Palestinians to an unending cycle of suffering and strife. So make no mistake, Hamas should never again be able to project terror from Gaza into the sovereign state of Israel. And we will continue to work together for a safer, more secure future for Israel and a brighter future for the Palestinians. The United States will keep pushing relentlessly for the safe return of hostages in Gaza. And we will continue to help Israel in its efforts to bring them all home.
And Defense Minister Gallant addressed international criticism of Israel's military tactics.
Secretary Austin, we both know the complexities of war. We both fought brutal terrorist organizations. We know that it takes time. Unlike our enemies, we are defending our values and we operate according to international law. The IDF is operating to minimize the harm to civilian population. We are also working with international partners to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian aid. Yet, any time we discuss humanitarian issues, we must remember the 129 hostages we held in Gaza. This is the most humanitarian issue.
He also said that Israeli Defense Forces are complying with a United Nations resolution concerning military action against Hezbollah, which comes as the Iran-backed Lebanese terror group continues attacks in northern Israel.
On October 8th, a day after Hamas attack, Hezbollah opened fire unprovoked. The threats of rockets, missiles, and drones is unacceptable. Over 80,000 citizens have been displaced, living as refugees in their own country. We are determined to create a new reality, restoring security in the area, based on UN Resolution 1701, pushing back Hezbollah. We will bring back the residents of the north to their homes on the border. After full security will be restored, we prefer to do so via understanding ensuring that the border region is clear of terrorists and does not allow direct threats of our citizens.
The main focus of the meeting, Gaza's post-war future. Here's more on that from Secretary Austin.
Now, we know that the past 72 days have been some of the most painful days in Israel's history. But it would compound this tragedy if all that was waiting for the Israeli people and your Palestinian neighbors at the end of this awful war was more insecurity, fury, and despair. As I've said, Israelis and Palestinians have both paid too bitter a price to just go back to October 6th. So I discuss pathways today toward a future for Gaza after Hamas, based upon the clear principles laid down last month by my friend, Secretary Blinken. Israelis and Palestinians both deserve a horizon of hope. So the United States continues to believe, as we have under administrations of both parties, that it is in the interest of both Israelis and Palestinians to move forward toward two states, living side by side in mutual security. Now, we know how hard that is, especially after October 7th. But ongoing instability and insecurity only play into the hands of Hamas. So we must think together about what lies beyond this terrible season of terror and war. And as we do, the United States will remain deeply committed to the security and self-defense of the State of Israel. As John F. Kennedy said in 1960, America's friendship with Israel is a national commitment. That was true then, and it's even truer now. The United States will remain Israel's closest friend in the world. And as I've said repeatedly, our support for Israel's security remains unshakable, and it always will.
You can see the entire press conference with Secretary Austin and Defense Minister Gallant at cspan.org. And more now on the news from over the weekend of Israeli forces killing three hostages held by Hamas terrorists. The White House said today the incident could force a change in the IDF's rules of engagement. Here's National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
The IDF admitted that they made a mistake very, very soon after they made the mistake. And I have no doubt that they will do the forensics on this. To learn what happened and how to avoid it happening again. It's tragic, it's sad, and you can't imagine that those IDF soldiers who pulled that trigger and killed those hostages feel very good about what they did. Of course not. It's a traumatic event. And they'll have to do the forensics on this to figure out what happened. The last thing I'll say on this, Zeke, is that, sometimes an event like this, a tactical event, does require you to take a look at your rules of engagement and maybe make adjustments. Sometimes not. Sometimes the issue isn't the rules of engagement. Sometimes it's just the way they're enforced or the interpretation of it by a unit on the ground or by an individual soldier. And that's why doing the forensics on this is going to be so important for them to kind of figure out, is there a systemic issue, i.e. the rules, or was this an individual issue, misunderstanding, miscalculation, fog of war? I mean, we just don't know. We don't have the details. But I think it would. I think we should be careful at this early stage, certainly from here, from Washington, to point the fingers at the exact rules of engagement.
John Kirby also announced today that Defense Secretary Austin will hold a virtual meeting tomorrow with other Middle Eastern defense ministers to discuss the ongoing Houthi attacks on commercial vessels in the Red Sea. Now, this meeting comes after the U.S. Navy destroyer USS Kearney responded to another distress call early today, this one from a commercial vessel in the Red Sea after it was attacked by what the Pentagon called multiple projectiles. Now, like Hamas, the Houthis are supported by Iran. Secretary Austin called the attacks reckless, dangerous, and a violation of international law. Back here in Washington, Vice President Kamala Harris and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff were among the dignitaries paying their respects to the late Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. The body of the nation's first female Supreme Court justice is lying in repose at the court's Great Hall. She passed away on December 1st at the age of 93. Also paying their respects today, Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins, and New Hampshire Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan. All nine current justices attended a private ceremony at the court this morning following the casket's arrival. That event included comments from current Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Some years ago, my colleagues and I were at lunch discussing the bygone era of the court when justices were openly hostile to each other and rarely interacted personally. It was a sad chapter in our court's history. One colleague asked, when did that change? Someone suggested a particular Chief Justice. Another named a different Chief Justice. Ruth, in her characteristically quiet yet commanding voice, said, "It all changed when a woman came to the court." Those at the table who had served with Sandra shook their heads vigorously in agreement. My friend Clarence once described Sandra as the glue of this court. I agree. She brought us all together, even after she retired. The first day I came to work in this building, Sandra was at my office door to welcome me to the court. Of the many topics she covered, the one she seemed most intent to get across was the importance of regularly attending the justices' lunch after arguments and conferences. The collegiality of the court, Sandra explained, was vital to getting our work done in a manner the country would respect. She was, as with so many things, prescient in that regard. Later that first day, when I met with the Chief Justice, he told me that Sandra had made him promise that he would lead attendances at our lunches, impressing upon him the importance of building our relationships with one another. The Chief today still honors his promise to Sandra and rarely misses a lunch. Sandra was also known for dragging colleagues out of their offices by linking her arms through theirs and walking them to the lunchroom whenever she noticed that their attendance was lagging. Many of the justices who served with her, including some here today, experienced this firsthand. Sandra shared herself, her family, her home, and even her friends fully with her colleagues, and she expected the same from all of us. However, the lunches and the many other get-togethers Sandra initiated, including dinners, movies, barbecues, and visits to the theater and museums, were almost never about the food, the show, or the occasional scotch and water. They were about bringing us closer to one another and ensuring that we got to know each other as full people. She knew the value of this. She practiced it firsthand when she was the first female majority leader of the Arizona Senate, famously bringing together her colleagues on both sides of the aisle for routine barbecues. So she understood that personal relationships were critical to working together, even and especially in the face of adversity or strenuous disagreement.
And you can see all of that service and a live stream of the Great Hall right now at cspan.org. Tomorrow, Justice O'Connor's funeral service will take place at Washington National Cathedral. President Biden is among those scheduled to speak. And our live coverage of that begins at 11 a.m. Eastern Time here on C-SPAN Radio. It'll also be live on C-SPAN and streamed at cspan.org and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. The U.S. Department of Transportation is ordering Southwest Airlines to pay a $140 million penalty for the massive flight delays and cancellations during last year's holiday travel season. The fine is by far the largest ever for consumer protection violations, according to the DOT. A major winter storm last year caused travel disruptions across the country, but while other airlines recovered, Southwest flights ground to a halt. In the end, more than 16,000 flights were canceled and more than 2 million passengers were stranded. The fine is part of a consent order that requires Southwest to set up a $90 million compensation fund going forward for passengers affected by significant travel delays and cancellations. Campaign 2024 news now. Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley has launched a new ad that takes direct aim at President Biden's age.
I'll just say it. Biden's too old, and Congress is the most exclusive nursing home in America. Washington keeps failing because politicians from yesterday can't lead us into tomorrow. We need term limits, mental competency tests, and a real plan to defeat China and restore our economy. We have to leave behind the chaos and drama of the past with a new generation and a new conservative president. I'm Nikki Haley, and I approve this message.
Now, you might notice that missing from that is anything about Republican frontrunner and former President Donald Trump's age. He is 77. Now, the former U.N. ambassador and South Carolina governor is running a distant second to him in polls, but her campaign has seen some growing momentum in recent weeks. According to her campaign, the ad will run statewide in Iowa and New Hampshire. You can find more of our campaign 2024 coverage at cspan.org. And don't forget our new weekly wrap-up, 2024 Campaign Trail. It's a one-stop shop to see where the candidates are traveling across the country and what they're saying to voters. You can also get perspective from political reporters, the latest poll and fundraising numbers, and campaign ads like that. You can watch it Friday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN and stream it anytime at cspan.org. You can also download it as a podcast on our free C-SPAN Now mobile app or wherever you get your podcasts. That's also where you can find this program as a podcast. It's also on YouTube. Just search Washington Today. And for more on the stories that are shaping Washington every day, get our free daily email, word for word. Go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.